of the day is case number 2011-40572, Jerry Hartfield versus Rick Thaler.
May it please the court, James P. Sullivan for the director. Before I begin this morning, please note that my wife is in the 37th week of her pregnancy. If she calls the clerk's office to advise that she's gone into labor, I will request permission to leave the courtroom so that I might return to her side.
Well, we hope you can make it through the argument, but best wishes to your wife.
Thank you very much. She's the tougher lawyer of the two of us today. More than three decades after a state court convicted him of murdering a woman with a mattock, Jerry Hartfield filed a habeas application in state or in federal court. Hartfield concedes that this was over a decade too late under the AEDPA statute of limitations, 2244D. But Hartfield argues, and the district courts held, that 2244D does not apply to him. This court should reject that argument. Hartfield is a person in custody pursuant to the judgment of a state court within the meaning of 2244D.
Should we certify that question?
No,
the Court of Criminal Appeals, and why not?
This court should not certify that question to the Court of Criminal Appeals, or which I'll call the CCA today, for two reasons. First of all, the answer to the question of whether or not there is actually a valid state court judgment doesn't really change the analysis under 2244D, and certifying the question to the CCA will give encouragement to other prisoners in future cases to try similar artful pleading to what has happened.
Are you saying there are other prisoners in Texas who have been held in prison for 30 years without a conviction, so that there's going to open the floodgates for people held where there is no valid conviction?
No, Your Honor, but what I am saying is that Hartfield has the good fortune to be represented by able counsel from the Federal Public Defender's Office in this case. But in future cases, you can expect that pro se prisoners, in an effort to get out of all of the different threshold procedural requirements that the federal habeas statute imposes on persons in custody pursuant to the judgment of a state court.
Well, that's the nub. Is there a judgment of a state court?
And the answer to that question is yes. You'll find it at tab Q of our record excerpts. But
could the governor's commutation prevent the CCA's mandate from becoming final in this case? And if so, what authority says that?
I don't think that the governor's commutation could have prevented the CCA's mandate from becoming final. What the governor's commutation did was satisfy the condition announced by the CCA, because I think it's important to remember here that in Texas courts, as in the federal courts, the mandate is not read as a four corners document. The mandate must be understood, read in conjunction with the appellate court's opinion. So this court has said that, for example, in Tollett versus City of Kima, and we've cited cases from the Texas courts to the same effect. What the CCA said in this case, when it basically ruled on the government's motions for a hearing, is that it said, we recognize that on direct appeal in Hartfield's case, the only constitutional error we've identified is a punishment phase error. But as a matter of state law in existence at the time, which has since been legislatively overruled, the CCA said, we have to get rid of the judgment of conviction as well as the punishment sentence of death unless the governor comes in and commutes the sentence, because the CCA at the time did not think itself able to change the sentence. And so when the government in this case, asked for a reasonable period of time to seek commutation, the CCA said, we will give you that time. This happened in other cases as well, where the governor came in and commuted the sentence to fix a punishment phase problem. And what the CCA said in its opinion is we think that the 15-day period between the end of our decision and the issuance of our mandate is a reasonable time to seek that commutation from the governor.
Right. And didn't that 15-day window close on October 2nd, 1980, 15 days after the CCA's decision reversed the conviction?
No, Your Honor, not at all. The 15-day period is a 15-day period from the decision on the last motion for a hearing. So in this case, that 15-day period closed on March 16, 1983.
But that motion was a motion for leave to file a motion for rehearing, not a motion for rehearing. And Rule 310 does not refer to motions for leave.
Well, I would say a few things in response to this. First of all, Your Honor, it can't be the case that the 15-day period started on October 2nd, 1980, or any of those dates, because the CCA hadn't even yet said that it was opening the 15-day window. That didn't happen until 1983, on January 26th, 1983. And as to the second point that Your Honor has raised about that being a ruling on the motion for leave to file the motion for rehearing rather than on the motion itself, that also can't be what was going on here. If it were true that the pendency of a motion for leave to file would not forestall finality of the CCA's judgment, then we would have expected the mandate to have issued sometime in 1980. The timeline here is that the CCA's opinion comes out on September 17th, 1980. Exactly 15 days later, the state files its first motion for rehearing and motion for leave to file the same. Now, if the law in the state of Texas were, as Your Honor has suggested here, then the mandate would have issued that day, the day that they filed the motion for leave to file. But of course, that didn't happen. Another 70 days passed before, on November 26th, 1980, the CCA granted leave to file that first motion for rehearing. And then about 3 years later, the CCA ruled on that first motion for rehearing and said, we're going to reject it. And that's when they said, and we're going to give you a 15-day window to seek commutation. Because as the CCA acknowledged in that case, it's a rather burdensome remedy to force a whole new trial when it's only a punishment phase issue.
Mr. Hawk, correct me. The impression I get when we get past all of this which day, what happened, arcane stuff, is that both sides agree that this needs remedy, but one says to turn him loose, that's you, and the other says to exhaust state remedies. Is this a fair qualification of...
I'm not sure if I'm understanding your question. Because I represent the director, I don't think that we should turn Hartfield loose. I think that his habeas application should be dismissed with prejudice because it's time barred.
Right. You don't agree that there was error here and that the mandate issued and he is in custody. You don't agree with any of that. You think he loses.
I'm sorry, I called you Hawk. I meant Sullivan.
Oh, no problem. I'm sorry.
But my question is just that. I think you answered it. Maybe the question wasn't clear, but that you're contending that there needs to be an exhaustion of state remedies.
No, Your Honor. In fact, just the opposite. This court should only affirm without prejudice on the exhaustion ground if it rejects our argument that Hartfield is a person in custody pursuant to the judgment of a state court. Judge Elrod's first question here about certifying this question to the CCA might be a more elegant route to getting a state law answer from a state court on this state law question. But
what is the exhaustion we're talking about?
Well, the exhaustion that we're talking about here is that Hartfield has raised a speedy trial claim, but he has not yet presented that claim to the state courts in a procedurally proper manner. And until he has done that, the judicially created exhaustion doctrine, which dates back to the Supreme Court's ex parte Royal decision, will prevent any federal court from entertaining his federal habeas application. And so he would need to go back to the state trial court, request a new trial on speedy trial grounds. If that is denied, go to the CCA and then seek the writ of mandamus, having checked that first procedural box.
So instead of 30 years, it'll be 40.
Right. By that time, maybe my kids will have had some kids. Right. So but that's not what we think should happen here. We think that this case should end here now. We think that this court should vacate and remand with instructions to dismiss with prejudice because this application is time barred. And to come back to Judge Elrod's opening question here, I made a statement and with my glasses, I can see the eyebrows raised. It doesn't really matter what the answer to the state law question of whether there's actually a valid judgment here is. And I'd like to say a little bit about why that's so. That's so because the language in the habeas statute, and we've tried to trace some of the history in our brief, and I wish I had had the Cobb opinion before I had to write all of that. We've tried to explain why, when we get back to the basics of how federal habeas works for state prisoners, we see that Hartfield's case is, in fact, very much like almost every other state prisoner case that this court and other federal courts will see. Hartfield has come into the federal court, and he has said, I'm being detained illegally. This puts the onus on the custodian, here my client, the director, to explain the basis for lawful custody. And to do that, as we usually do in these cases, we've pointed to the state court judgment, which, again, you can find at tab Q. And then Hartfield's reply...
Which is non-existent.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that.
Under Texas law.
No, Your Honor, I would disagree with that.
What Texas law says that you can resurrect the judgment in this case.
We think that the CCA's opinion in this very case says that. The CCA's opinion said that we would have 15 days to essentially salvage or protect the state court's 1977 judgment from the mandate mandate of reversal. So when the March 4th opinion, or rather the March 4th, 1983 mandate comes down from the CCA, you read that in conjunction with the CCA's opinion, which said you have 15 days, and that 15-day period started on March 1st, 1983, and then the governor issued the commutation 14 days later with a day to spare on March 15th, 1983. Now, when that happened, the state trial court advised the CCA, I understand, you'll see it in the postcard at tab K of the record excerpts, I understand myself to have followed your mandate because the commutation came within 15 days, the sentence has been executed, and it's commuted to life imprisonment. If at that time the CCA believed that that was flouting of its mandate, it retained jurisdiction to issue a writ of mandamus to say, state trial court, that's not what we said at all. This ended in January of 1983.
But there was no one there to ask the CCA at that point. He wasn't represented. He didn't ask the CCA.
With
respect, and so shouldn't we ask the CCA whether they were flouted or not? Isn't that the easiest way to resolve this case?
No, Your Honor, and with respect, that's factually incorrect. Mr. Hartfield was represented by counsel at that time.
Nobody went to the CCA to see if it was too late at that point.
That's right, and Hartfield should have done that. That if he believed it's of a very recent vintage that Hartfield has decided that he doesn't want to acknowledge the existence of the state court's judgment in this case. Until 2007, he and his lawyer, and he was represented by counsel at that time, did not contend that the state court judgment was, as you put it, non-existent.
Counsel, it seems to me it was in both sides' interest to get clarity out of the Court of Criminal Appeals in 1983, whatever happened, it was not exactly according to what the Court of Criminal Appeals said. It may have been an ineffective second motion for leave. It may have been a variety of things. So I think the onus was on both sides, not you, but whoever was around in 1983. Let me make sure which judgment you say is in effect and is perhaps defective in some way, but at least is, at worst, is defective in some way, though you're not conceding that, but at least is the judgment of conviction. Is it the Court of Criminal Appeals order, or is it the 1977 District Court, I guess you call them, order? What is the judgment under which this person is being held?
The judgment is the State Trial Court's 1977 judgment at tab Q of the record excerpts.
Well, why under Nickerson is that not a non-existent judgment now?
It's not a non-existent judgment because the government and the trial court satisfied every condition that the CCA imposed in its mandate and its opinion. The CCA said
it was reversed by the CCA. How does it?
Your Honor, I don't think that you should just read the four corners of the mandate at tab M. I think that you have to read it as a matter of state law in conjunction with the CCA's opinion.
But you're saying the opinion? There are two opinions. There was one at the time reversing the conviction, and there's one subsequently later.
That's right.
That was appended to it. But that opinion is not part of the mandate. The mandate was the first opinion. You've conflated the two opinions. One is much later, well beyond the time.
No, Your Honor, that's incorrect too. I'm sorry to say the opinion.
Don't be sorry.
Okay, the opinion, the two opinions. I'll put it that way. If that gives everyone.
There
comfort.
Are two opinions. It's not just comfort. That's the way it is in those book. Isn't that right?
No, that's.
There are two opinions in this case.
Okay.
They are next to each other. The court chose to file them next to each
yes.
other. But if you go to the reporter, they are two different opinions issued on two different days.
Yes, they were two different opinions issued on two different days.
Thank you.
And the mandate, that's right, and I also don't think that it changes the outcome of this case at all. The mandate did not issue after the first of the opinions came down from the CCA. It issued after the second of the opinions came down from the CCA. So again, the CCA's second opinion is January 26, 1983, and it's not until March 4th, so well more than 15 days after that January 26, 1983 opinion comes down, that they issued their mandate. And that mandate must be read in conjunction with both of the CCA's opinions. And those CCA opinions, particularly the January 26, 1983 opinion, makes quite clear that the CCA understood itself to be opening a 15-day window in which the governor, through a commutation, could salvage the 1977 state trial court judgment. That's exactly what happened here.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Let's say that it didn't happen quite in the way that it did. There was never a commutation. Is there no judgment of conviction?
Yes.
You would agree with that? Okay, so we got that settled. What if the commutation had come beyond the 15 days? You don't have, there's a question here of whether it was timely or not. Mm-hmm. Let's say you had to concede it was an untimely commutation. Would you also agree in that situation that there's no judgment of conviction?
Subject to one caveat, we would. And here's what we would say about that. Because we've said read the mandate with the opinion gave a 15-day window, and we submit that that window closed March 16th, 1983. So if I understand your hypothetical, Judge Southwick, you're saying suppose that the commutation came March 20th. If that happened, then the only way we could say that there's a judgment in light of the CCA's mandate and opinions, would be to say that we did seek, because that was the word the CCA used, we did seek the commutation in the letter, which you can find in the record, from the state trial judge, the district attorney, and the sheriff. So that was, I believe, on, January 31st, 1983, the state trial judge, the district attorney, and the sheriff send a letter to the Board of Pardons and Paroles saying, let's get the wheels turning, we need a commutation, we don't want to retry this man because it would traumatize the victim's daughter and the evidence is stale. And so we did seek but not secure at that time. But subject to that one caveat, and that would be a more aggressive reading of the CCA's opinions and mandate, but Your Honor is correct. The CCA's mandate would have rendered the state trial court judgment a nullity had the governor failed to issue his commutation in a timely fashion. But that's not what happened in this case.
Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Ken Hawk. I'm an assistant to the federal defender in Tyler, Texas. And although Mr. Sullivan's about to enter his journey into parenthood, half of my six are here today with my wife. Whether the counsel for the director agrees with me or does not agree with me and with Mr. Hartfield on how this case should be settled, the reality is the series of events are really not in dispute. It's going to be the lens through which we deal with these series of events, which will be crucial for the court's decision. The challenge I face is to give you a concise and clear understanding of how we say, and Mr. Hartfield says, to look at these series of events.
Well, let me ask you, what is the ultimate decision we have to make in order to rule in your favor, to affirm, I suppose, or you may want us to slightly change what the judge did? Is the issue of whether there is a judgment of conviction under which he, of conviction, a judgment under which he is being held in the usual sense that may be challengeable, but at least is not non-existent?
I would take the seminal question, the threshold key question, one half step before that. We say that the issues are like dominoes, and the reality is there is a single domino, the direction of which falls in whatever appointed direction, that's going to decide the entire case. And that question is, what is the posture of Mr. Hartfield's case today? Are his complaints pretrial complaints, or are they all post-conviction complaints? Once that question is answered, the direction of the whole case flows. For example, were this court to determine that the district court is incorrect, that these are all post-trial complaints, AEDPA, we've got the year statute challenge, Mr. Hartfield's not going to overcome that. That will be dispositive of the balance of the issues. If this court says that the district court was correct, these are all pretrial complaints, then flows the analysis of one specific issue after another in this cause. So I would say that would be the first question to answer. Mr. Hartfield contends this is absolutely a pretrial case. As he sits here today, we're pretrial. How do we know that? And this is going to be key for us, is to give you the flavor and context of the events read beyond simply dates and times. Here's what I mean. June 30th, 1977, in Horton County, Texas, Mr. Hartfield suffered conviction for capital murder. He took his direct appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeals alleging three errors covered by 4 points. Those three errors are important. One, that the defendant's statement, referred to in counsel's briefs as a confession, was admitted unlawfully. The record shows He was arrested, Mr. Hartfield, in Kansas. He was appointed counsel in Kansas. He had counsel. Waived his extradition, gets in a DPS police car, and comes to Texas. It was on that trip that Mr. Hartfield, who is shown in the record to be illiterate, there is also an indication in the briefs, he's got an IQ in the 50s, has what many concerned think is a backseat to interview. It results in a statement from the defendant used against him at guilt innocence. His second complaint was that of jury selection, the Witherspoon error. His third complaint was that the prosecutor at guilt innocence made an unlawful argument causing should cause reversal, that he actually stated to the jury that Mr. Hartfield came back to take his hate out on a white woman. That was complained of at trial. Those were the first complaints to the Court of Criminal Appeals. Interestingly, 1980, the court does what it always does, what most courts will do. It examines a record in its entirety. If there's an issue that requires reversal and remand, there's no need to exhaust the time, effort, and expense to look through the whole record to find and pass judgment. And that's what they did. They found the Witherspoon error. They made the decision in the original opinion, reverse and remand for an entirely new trial. Fascinatingly, interestingly, and frustratingly, the Court of Criminal Appeals was completely silent on the propriety of the jury argument at guilt innocence, as well as the propriety of his first issue, that of the confession.
What happens to those claims? I was wondering when I was reading it, those claims just disappeared. And so what's...
That's Mr. Hartfield's challenge. And when we look through the analysis of the case, for the inference about what this must mean when the Court of Criminal Appeals reversed and remanded, the director's position today actually supports a disposition that says that Mr. Hartfield suffers or has imposed upon him a life sentence without ever having two substantive guilt-innocence complaints successfully litigated on appeal. Mr. Sullivan declared for the court that the Court of Criminal Appeals reading was that the only error was found at the punishment phase. I read it differently. That's the one it dealt with. And it did go to an exhaustive description of what Witherspoon error requires.
But it just didn't need to reach the other because it was already reversing. And so Yes. Those have not been adjudicated.
Yes, Your Honor.
If we read the opinion as closely as you have, will it refer to those other issues and give us some indication that both sides can grab onto as to what they thought of those other claims?
Your Honor, I read the opinion several times. The first time I thought I missed it. The second time I was clear I did not miss it. The first complaint, that of the defendant's statement, was mentioned in the first paragraph of the first opinion of the Court of Criminal Appeals, and here endeth the discussion. There was not a word spoken of it, nor of the issue revolving around the jury argument. It just wasn't dealt with. Summarily not dealt with. And that's the challenge Mr. Hartfield faces. It's a wonderful example of why, in this specific case, and I'll shift over a little bit to the concept of mandate, commutation was never appropriate for this case. It could have, the Mr. Hartfield says that the governor could have issued commutation the day after the opinion reversing was sent out. It would not have been appropriate. This is absolutely not a case where the only issue was found to be a punishment issue. Yes, they absolutely dealt with what Witherspoon error means and that you have to reverse the whole case, but they didn't deal with those other two substantive claims. And that's why we say, and Mr. Hartfield contends, that this is clearly a challenge of logistics.
But why wasn't this raised in 1980? Who was on deck and why weren't they watching?
The record is silent as to that answer, but it's one that is shared by reasonable people who read all of this record. Who was asleep at the switch? And I will tell the court that that folds nicely into the next point that Mr. Hartfield has. We tell juries all the time that the defendant's job in our criminal justice system is to sit there and be prosecuted. That's the only thing you have to do. The system of government is responsible for taking, if it can, your freedom, taking, if it can, your life, proving, if it can, from the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt you're guilty of a crime. The government, all branches, have to do what they do properly. Mr. Hartfield did not raise that in 1980 when the decision came back. I wish somebody would have made further inquiry into the court's decision. Regrettably, that didn't happen. But we can trace the case, and I won't go step by step, but I can tell the court that when we ask, and Mr. Hartfield asked in his federal writ, for the ultimate sanction on the state for failing to do what they're supposed to have done, there's a speedy trial issue. I'm going to talk first about the concept, second about the concept of speedy trial, and first about the process that got him there. When mandate issued, that was final. And I know Rule 310 reads differently depending upon how we want the case to resolve. A simple reading of 310 simply says that upon the final, when the judgment of the court's final mandate issues, there's not a qualifier. The 15-day concept, I argue, is an instruction to the litigants. You're going to have 15 days. We're not going to issue our opinion and then give mandate the next afternoon at 3 o'clock. It's not a limiting instruction on the court. It's guidance for the parties. But most importantly, we say this, and it was spoken at the district court level, that perhaps certifying to the Court of Criminal Appeals for explanation about what mandate means would give guidance. Mr. Hartfield suggests the United States Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals needs very little guidance from the state of Texas on what a mandate means. We think a mandate is what it is. It's an instruction to lower court. And there was a tragic error in this case. It was a series of events. Texas, for 28 years, fundamentally misappraised the posture of the case. I wish somebody would have said back in 1980, the Court of Criminal Appeals, in its opinion, read together with mandate, says he gets an entirely new trial. They sent a postcard back saying that the mandate's been satisfied because of a commutation that came after mandate. I wish somebody would have said, that's not how it works. I wish the Court of Criminal Appeals would have. At that time, there was no one on that switch.
When you say you wish the Court of Criminal Appeals had, one thing that strikes me about the government director's argument is that nobody asked the Court of Criminal Appeals to do anything. Is that correct? In 1983, they got notice, but nobody filed a motion. No one suggested the Court of Criminal Appeals should speak.
That's correct.
All right. Did commutation first become an issue? Was that in the filing after the motion to leave was granted in 1980? Was the state talking about a commutation at that time?
They had spoken. The record shows that commutation became an issue with the state's first motion for rehearing. Recalling back at that period of time, Witherspoon had just come out the summer before this specific decision. In fact, Mr. Hartfield's case was reversed on the same day with two others. It was widely recognized to be a solution to cases that had only punishment error, that commutation may fix that error, thereby removing the concept of the death penalty from people and avoiding the entirely new trial issue. So it was raised at that motion for new trial.
A footnote in one of your briefs says that one of the three people whose convictions were reversed on the same day did have a commutation back at that time. Any explanation for the difference?
I don't have an explanation for the difference. I think the record is silent as to legal.
Was there any case law made about the effectiveness of that commutation? Perhaps his reversal, the other defendant's reversal, doesn't have the same issues that yours does, but has that been explored? And is there no law that exists as a result of those others?
We can find no authority of a similar case where we had the timing of the commutation that came after the mandate. As far as litigation on the issue, it's too novel.
Well, if the commutation was prior to the mandate, is there case law to say that satisfy the Court of Criminal Appeals without further order by the Court of Criminal Appeals?
If commutation occurred before mandate, yes, there were cases that were reversed and mandate did not issue and commutation occurred. And there are so many different ways that was achieved back then. Sometimes there was actually mandate before it issued, the commutation occurred, the parties would dismiss the appeal. There were several different logistical fashions to clean the appellate record so that there was never a situation where you had, like Mr. Hartfield, a mandate sitting there followed by an executive order of a commutation. We couldn't find anything the same as this, is my best answer for you, Judge.
Yes. This again, as I ask counsel opposite, may be an oversimplification, but I have the impression that the only difference in the parties ask what they're asking us to do is one is to send it back so it's a without prejudice and send it back for, quote, exhaustion of state remedies, and the other is just to reverse with prejudice and dismiss. Is that correct or not?
It is correct. I'd like to add to that some, Your Honor, because in analysis of the case and review of the briefs, I've tried to be creative in what this court can do within the confines of the record, not requiring remand. I think the court said it best. We're at 30 years, so we're trying to get to 40, and our goal is not to. We're looking for finality. Mr. Hartfield says, candidly, there comes a point in time, and we hope it's 29 years and 5 months and counting, between the time of the reversal and the mandate that he issued, and today he's still not had his fair trial. We say, Mr. Hartfield says, it's just time to make the declaration that Texas is 29 years of fundamentally misunderstanding what he had been given by the court and it never happening. That's just long enough. That speedy trial raised issue is, I tend to be hypnotized by the complexity of it, but it's actually fairly simple. It's been 29 years. There's just not much more to be said from that. And everyone's got skin in the game. The Court of Criminal Appeals waited several years for their motion for rehearing to be granted. Mr. Hartfield absolutely waited 23 years for his first federal or state writ to hit. We have explanation from the record. I don't know what else to do, and I imagine...
My eyes are going to glaze over with all this.
Yes.
Yes or no?
Yes, and I'm going to add. First of all, I know that the director wants the case finished and says that Mr. Hartfield simply loses his post-conviction. We say, alternatively, one, he should have his case dismissed, that the district court was just wrong in not doing it. And we're going to ask you to reverse that. But there is another alternative, and it's slightly different. There's been references made to certifying to the Court of Criminal Appeals. Our position is this, and this is the thing that we came up with because it may just be what the record supports, and that's this. Not remanding the case to the Court of Criminal Appeals, but rather giving full force and effect to the Court of Criminal Appeals' original order and satisfying what the district courts in the federal system said and remanding the case to Wharton County's district court, where finally he can have his motion for speedy trial heard for the first and only time, because that is a pre-trial remedy. Texas Code of Criminal Procedure 27, I think the district court mentioned that. We say he shouldn't have to do that, but I've got to be candid with the court. That may be the best place.
You don't have any authority that he shouldn't have to do it except that, oh my gosh, it's just been too long. The authority would say that because it has to be raised through an challenge the indictment, that the speedy trial claim must be challenged to the indictment, that you have to go back and be remanded for exhaustion. That's where all the authority is. Even if you win over his claim that it's post-conviction, even if you win, you're going to have to go back because the way that Texas does exhaustion in speedy trial, aren't you? You have no authority to do it differently.
The short answer is yes, but I'm going to absolutely caveat it, and here's why. Because understanding that the post-conviction, pre-conviction argument, if the court lands on the fact he is pre-conviction, exhaustion in the 2241 is not a requirement in the federal system. It's just not. This is judicially created to give the state an opportunity to correct their error. With all due respect to the state of Texas, Mr. Hartfield went 6 years ago to the Court of Criminal Appeals, and the very first thing he complained about was a complaint involving Article 1, Section 10, the first line of which is, where's my speedy trial? It's speedy trial. He complained about it in the state of Texas, the very first writ, and his very second writ. Texas has had their opportunity to fix this problem.
Well, let me ask you on that. They found it to be a successive petition back in 06 or 07, whenever that was done.
Their postcard responses would lead me to conclude that they were simply dismissed out of hand, without opinion, not given deference or even honest consideration.
Well, counsel, among the considerations, a lot of which you don't agree with, of certifying the Court of Criminal Appeals, to what extent could you say that this issue has, in some legitimate way, been presented to the Court of Criminal Appeals back in 07 or whatever the year was when Hartfield was going a different route? Did those pleadings, did that application raise the kind of issues that we're talking about now?
The first one made reference to it. There was a subsequent letter to the first one, a memo attached, but the second writ to the Court of Criminal Appeals was very specific. I did not get the trial I was ordered to get, which calls in some respect to what Judge Elrod said. Where was the Court of Criminal Appeals in 1983? Well, in 2007, they had a request saying, I've never got my trial. It was incumbent upon the state to at least check and say, wait a minute, let's look at this case. Turns out he's right or not. It's just summarily dismissed it.
Right, but it's never been posed to the CCA. Is he in prison under a pre or post because the underlying judgment has been is gone? And don't you think that they should have that opportunity to squarely address that issue rather than us trying to construe 310 for the first time in this extremely novel context?
My answer would have been yes, it's their position. Sometime after 3, 5, 8, 9, 11 years, Judge, after 30 years, our position is they've just lost their opportunity at this point.
Well, it's my experience that when we give certified questions and they graciously accept them, that they tend to answer them in a reasonable manner.
I would suspect that they would. Our challenge is they can't do it for 30 years, and so our position is they should have done it before that. Your Honors, thank you for your patience and indulgence. We ask that the court affirm the decision of the district court that he's, in fact, pretrial, reverse the district court, and ask that this court declare that he should be having a speedy trial claim granted and dismissed with prejudice. Thank you.
In reply to just a few of the questions, Judge Southwick asked whether in 1980 the government had asked for commutation. The answer is yes. At tab O of the record excerpts on page, I believe, 5 of our first motion for a hearing, we raised the possibility of solving the punishment phase error by getting a commutation from the governor.
Is that the 2-plus-year delay? Was the Court of Criminal Appeals your best surmise waiting for a commutation to come in?
No, I don't think so, because in addition to seeking a commutation in that motion for a hearing, we also challenged the substantive decision on the Witherspoon claim. Among other things, I believe we pointed out that the juror in that case, Hlozek, who was the basis for the Witherspoon error, had been also excused for the same reason in another case, and the CCA had said that it was okay. So we weren't going to try to get a commutation until we first got some closure from the CCA. And then in the January 26th, 1983 opinion, the CCA said, we're going to reject your argument about Witherspoon. There is a punishment phase error, and we're going to give you a 15-day window. And as we submit, that opened on March 1st, 1983. Now, my friend in opposition has said that commutation was somehow inappropriate in this case because of the nature of his claims. But the CCA clearly disagreed with that. The CCA, in its January 26, 1983 opinion, explicitly invited the state to go seek a commutation from the governor. So what that says about the strength of his coercion claim, I think I can leave it to you to decide. Now, I think in my remaining time at the podium, I want to try to convince you not to punt this question to the CCA, and I hope that you won't do so.
Do you know you consider Erie to be a punt?
I'm sure that many smarter people than me have written chapters in Hart and Wexler's about that. Here's why I think that it would be a punt in this case. It would be the unnecessary decision by a state court of a state law issue. And here's why I think it's unnecessary. The question for this court is not whether or not there's a valid state court judgment in this case. The question instead is, as a matter of federal law, under 2244D, whether Hartfield is a person in custody pursuant to the judgment of a state court. And the answer to whether this is a valid judgment or an invalid judgment is different than the question of whether he's a person in custody pursuant to the judgment. All of the discussion that we've had today about what that fight is eventually going to look like is a question, I think, for another day. My friend in opposition has candidly acknowledged that Hartfield has not filed a pointless stack of papers in this case. He has come in seeking his freedom, and he has explained that his detention is unlawful. We have tried to explain that the detention is lawful because of what we say is a valid state court judgment. So we've joined issue now on that point. And within the meaning of the federal habeas statute, that's enough. The statute does not say a person in lawful custody pursuant to the valid judgment of a state court. That's really no threshold determination at all. And so the fact that we've joined issue on this point is enough to mark Hartfield as a person in custody pursuant to the judgment of the state court.
Which judgment?
The 1977 tab Q judgment of the state trial court.
The Wharton County.
That's correct. That's exactly.
That's the one that under Nickerson doesn't exist.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. We've tried to explain in our brief why we believe that it does exist. But again, that's really kind of the merits question here. If Hartfield had timely filed his federal habeas application in 1997, then we would be in a position ultimately in deciding the merits of his federal habeas application, whether or not the state trial court's judgment authorizes his detention. But at the point where we're just trying to figure out how we classify him, it's not necessary to decide that question yet. If we got to that point, then it might make sense to certify this question to the CCA.
Well, counsel, when you were up earlier, I asked you whether if the commutation was well after the time period for the mandate, whether you would concede, and you did with a caveat, whether that would mean there was no judgment. It seems to me your point that you're making, as long as you have some argument that you can make that passes a test variously called the Laff test or something else, you're going to be under 2244.
I think that's exactly right, Judge Southwick. I think that you've stated exactly what this court's opinion should say in vacating and remanding with instructions to dismiss with prejudice. But, Judge Elrod, have I answered?
Does that answer your question, Judge Southwick?
Yeah.
Okay.
I remain perplexed why the state of Texas's lawyer would be encouraging us not to apply principles of federalism to allow the state of Texas to analyze its own judgments.
Your Honor, federalism points in just the opposite direction here for two reasons. First, the statute of limitations that was passed by the Congress in AEDPA supports federalism concerns by supporting the finality of state court judgments and bringing an end to federal habeas proceedings. The second reason, though, is that no principle of federalism of which I am aware counsels asking state courts to decide unnecessary state law questions. And that's exactly what would happen if you asked the CCA here.
If you don't believe it passes the Laff test or the smell test, then it's not an unnecessary issue, is it, sir?
I wouldn't agree with that either, Your Honor. But I hope that your keen
noses will
pick
up. I thought that's what you told Judge Southwick, that was the test.
I don't think that that's the – I think that the – well, okay, I suppose, yeah, depending on how keen the nose is, but I do hope that you'll find that it does pass the Laff test for all the reasons we've stated in the brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck to you and your wife.
Thank you.